The Quest, A Warrior's Tale, written by Bonnie S. Johnston, narrated by William Dupuy. Author's Notes. During the decades of researching genealogy, I've come across many individuals who contributed in some way to the settlement of this country. One of these people was the Delaware War Chief Killbuck, who is remembered for his violent raids against the early settlers of Virginia. He was a remarkable man and fought for his people during the tumultuous period of the French and Indian War. During the Revolutionary War, he turned his allegiance to the Americans. I have taken the few facts of his life and combined them with second-hand sources and imagination to reconstruct the life of this Native American chief who left many descendants today. Chapter 1. A tear slid slowly down his tan, wrinkled, and scarred cheek as the old chief looked down the hillside to the place where the great river began. He noted the British fort built on the ashes of old Fort Duquesne, nestled in the fork of the two rivers that form the Ohio, the beautiful river. He looked up in hope of seeing a sign, a great eagle soaring on the current, or a flock of passenger pigeons darkening the sky. But he did not. Through eyes dimmed with age, he saw only the cloudless blue sky and the orange ball that seemed cold and cruel. He saw no movement of life, no deer drinking at the river's edge, no canoes carrying warriors down the river, no remnants of his earlier life. He did note a flat boat filled with white settlers, disturbing the scene with harsh noise, not the reverent silence that his people showed on their passage on this river. The old chief lowered his eyes and turned, leaving the scene and walking toward his patient horse, whom he mounted bareback, and trotted down the river where he followed the shoreline west. He soon found two companions and rode for several miles until they found the fording spot and swam the animals across the river to the north shore. It was close to sunset as they headed toward the Tuscarawas Valley of the Ohio country. Killbuck, a former Delaware war chief, rode in silence, thoughts and images playing in his active mind. He was an old man by Indian standards, over 60, but still revered by his Delaware clan. Years before, during the French and Indian War, he had pursued his quest, the retaking of his clan's ancestral lands in colonial Virginia. He had failed, and remorse filled his heart. During and after the war, he lived in the village of Sawtuck, downriver from the French Fort Duquesne. Sawtuck now lay in ruins, abandoned by its people for the Ohio village of Newcomerstown. Before the war began, he had lived for several years among the settlers in the colony of Virginia, after his people had been driven west by the ever-encroaching English settlers. He learned English and English ways, and interacted with the settlers who were not yet numerous and threatening. By 1754, it became clear that the English would not cease their movement west, their taking of Indian land. The Virginia land, they said, was sold to them by the Iroquois, but Killbuck knew that the land was not the Iroquois to sell. It belonged to the red men, including the Delaware, his people, and he vowed to reclaim it. Killbuck was not certain of the year of his birth in what was now the colony of New Jersey. He thought it was 1710 by the English calendar, but the Delaware remembered it as the year of famine, a harsh winter where heavy snows prevented his clan, the Turtle Clan, from securing food. When snow piled high on the lodges, the river froze solid, and warriors could not track the deer. There were few white men near his village at that time, as most had settled by the great water, not inland in the deep woods. Killbuck learned his skills at the hand of Shingus and his brothers, revered warriors of the Wolf Clan who taught him to hunt and track, to shoot an arrow straight into the heart of a fleeing deer, and to be patient and honor the grandmother of all things. He also learned to read signs in nature, the rocks, the flowing waters, the towering trees that were inhabited by spirits of the earth. When he reached 13 years of age, Killbuck made his vision quest. He was tall and strong for his age, and left his clan to proceed into the dark forest, where he would seek the spirit who would watch over and guide and protect him during his life. Without food or water, he left his village, walking west into the virgin forest. He walked silently and carefully for many miles until his stomach cried out for food, and his mouth became dry and parched. He walked until darkness pervaded the forest when he came to a swiftly flowing stream, water cascading and frothing over rocks as it made its way along its course. With exhaustion, Kilbuck fell to the ground, watching the water until he became dizzy with weakness, and twilight dimmed his vision. How long he lay quietly, he did not know. It might have been hours. When he regained consciousness, it was night, blackness illuminated by a white moon, clouds floating across the orb in rapid succession. Nothing moved but the clouds, when he heard a noise, slight, but there, he knew. He stared at the flowing water and saw a shadow. He looked across the stream, and there it was, a large buck, antlers silhouetted by the moon above, standing on a flat rock in the middle of the stream. It was a beautiful sight, and Kilbuck knew it was his sign. He stood up and watched the buck, who remained still, and then the animal moved toward Kilbuck, stopping within yards of the frozen boy. Raising his nose to the sky, the buck let out a soft sound, wheeled, and jumped into the stream, soon disappearing into the black forest. If I had my quiver and arrows, I could have killed him and brought home a magnificent trophy, thought Kilbuck. But I could not kill such a beautiful animal. The buck's spirit will protect me. And so the boy returned to his village and told the tale of the fine buck. The warriors considered his story. The buck's spirit will be with you always. You did not kill him, and he will protect you. Even if you had shot an arrow through his heart, he would have lived. You have your sign and your name. When he reached the age of 23, he took a wife, Nyaswanan, daughter of a chief in a neighboring village. By 1740, she had presented him with a son known as Gelalemond, and two daughters who would later marry white settlers. As was the custom, Kilbuck took a second wife who presented him with a second son. Both women died before Kilbuck, and the other clans made the move from their birthplace to the frontiers of Virginia and Pennsylvania, and it was there that his two young daughters became acquainted with white settlers. The next 4 years, the Delaware lived peacefully in scattered bands among the early settlers of Virginia, while rumblings of discord continued between the French, who claimed the trade routes in both the Ohio and Mississippi valleys, and the English, whose lust for land would soon take them into the valleys with no regard for either the French or the Indians. Kilbuck studied these settlers and learned their languages, both English and German. One day in early 1753, Chingas, his clan, now settled in the village of Katanning in western Pennsylvania, sent a runner to Kilbuck's small village with a request for Kilbuck to meet with him and other leaders of the scattered Delaware bands. Kilbuck, taking his son Gelalemond with him, obliged and rode hastily north until he reached the village on the Allegheny River. Arriving on a lathered horse, he quickly dismounted in front of the council lodge and gave the reins to a young boy who smiled at the honor given him. His son and another warrior followed behind, serious looks on their young faces. A tall man with chiseled features, Chingas embraced Kilbuck and said, "Brother, I have just come from Logstown, where I and others met with the young English leader George Washington. He brought us many gifts, and wants us to side with the English father across the great water against the French. He said the English would soon take Fort Duquesne from the French, and we should be on the right side of this war." Kilbuck frowned and thought, for he had learned to trust no white man. "Do you believe him, brother? If we make a choice, I say we help the French. These traders do not take our land. They provide us with gunpowder and fine cloth. They buy our furs and give us a fair price. They do not fence the land that belongs to all of the red men. They take our women as wives." Chingas hesitated for a minute before he answered, "I will support neither, brother, not until we see which way the wind blows. If Washington takes the French fort, we will be forced to side with the English. Now we are caught between and do not want to side with a loser. What say you?
I do not like either the French or the English, but I will await the outcome as you have requested. I have learned both their languages and will learn to deal with whoever is victorious. My people will follow me when the decision is made. We will receive signs when the time comes.
Kilbuck watched Shingis's black eyes and saw indecision.
We will feast and pass the pipe while we consider our options. It is time for you to take your position as war chief. Come, brother.
Shingis, his silver bracelets jangling, led Kilbuck into the council house where the smell of venison stew embraced the area, and squaws scrambled to provide various dishes to the now seated chiefs. Chapter 2. Less than a year passed before George Washington and British soldiers tried to take Fort Duquesne. The expedition failed miserably, but Washington was paroled by the French and returned east. Kilbuck knew that most of the Delaware, the Shawnee, and other Ohio Valley tribes would now join the French, and he prepared his family and those with him that the time had come for their move to Sawtuck, close to Kittanning, Logstown, and Fort Duquesne. His position as war chief propelled him to influence, since the winds of war blew steadily along the Ohio Valley. Kilbuck, a pragmatic man, knew that the Delaware were in a precarious position, caught between two forces that were much more powerful than the various Indian tribes throughout the Ohio Valley. He was prepared for Shingis's alignment with the French, although there was much indecision among the scattered Delaware clans. He waited patiently for signs, as his followers settled into the small village of Sawtuck on the Allegheny River, where the great Netawatwees now stood as principal chief. Late that year, Shingis and Kilbuck and other powerful chiefs of the loosely organized Delaware met at Logstown, now a thriving trading village filled with traders, Indians, and French soldiers. It was a great council, a meeting of great importance. The French pled for the Indians' support, promising gifts of supplies, guns, and ammunition. Refusing gifts of rum, the chiefs gathered in the smoky council house later that evening, while silent squaws passed bark plates full of meat, bread, and squash. They could hear the drunken warriors as they consumed the jugs of liquor the chiefs had forbidden. Kilbuck hated the effect of the rum on the warriors and feared it was a bad sign. Rising in front of the seated warriors, Shingis chose his words carefully.
"Brothers, we must still remain neutral. We cannot be certain that the French will be the victors. The English General Braddock is making a great road to bring his soldiers west. We must be patient, brothers. We must see what happens. We will remain neutral for a while longer. I am not convinced that the French will defeat the English. They sometimes waver in their support of the red men. I have no liking for any white, but the French do not settle our lands, and they are fair traders. Our people have become dependent of supplies from the whites. Ammunition, guns, metal goods, cloth. It is too late to turn that around, I fear, and I mourn the loss of our ancestral ways."
"Brother," Kilbuck answered, "we will have to take a side soon, or we will be crushed in the middle of this war. The British are determined to take the land, to settle their children on it. They are already depleting our food supplies. Where the buffalo once roamed, there are none. Where the deer once thrived, there are now few.
You speak the truth, but we must choose sides wisely. We must watch for signs from the Great Spirit. We will wait a little longer."
His words were followed with shouts of anger.
"No, we must support the French. The English must be defeated. The time is here."
Kilbuck's face became a mask as thoughts flew through his mind, but he remained silent. In truth, he preferred the French, but he thought the British were superior in numbers, at least in the Ohio Valley. Shingis repeated his stand.
"It is true that Washington suffered a defeat at the hands of the French, but now General Braddock and 2,000 men are headed to try to take Fort Duquesne. The English want our support, but I will not give it to them. Not yet."
Shingis's eyes were deep and black,
and his countenance was threatening. No one doubted that he was in charge. The Delaware would continue to remain neutral for a while longer. Kilbuck would not disobey Shingis, the warrior he admired above all. A year passed before Shingis decided, and Kilbuck remained secluded in Sawtuck. The English General Braddock had come within miles of Fort Duquesne, where the Indians and French met them in battle. On the day after the battle, three Shawnee warriors rode into Logstown, and then to Sawtuck, British rifles and bayonets clutched in their hands, and scalps tied to their spears. It was not difficult for the Indians and their French allies to overwhelm the British, who remained in European-style military formations, allowing the Indians easily to pick them off, one by one. Braddock himself was killed by one of his own men, and the army disintegrated and fled. The 12 soldiers who were dragged back to the fort suffered horrible deaths, while the victorious Indians consumed rum and raised their tomahawks toward the east and the hated British. Victorious Shawnee and Mingo warriors galloped through the various villages, trophies hanging from spears, and British rifles held in their hands. Three Shawnee rode into Sawtuck, war-painted and bloody, scalps dangling from their spears and British bayonets at their sides. "Brothers," they screamed, "the English war chief is dead." Their warriors ran like frightened deer into the forest. "We killed many and captured 12, who now lie in ashes in front of the French fort. It was a sight to see, brothers." Kilbuck watched the excited warriors, and thoughts of war flew through his mind. He was a warrior and would soon be called upon to fight, regardless of Shingis's decision. Shortly after the news had spread, the chiefs of many Ohio tribes were called to a great council at Fort Duquesne, where over 1,000 warriors gathered. The victorious French made promises and supplied ammunition for the raids they hoped the Indians would lead to defeat the unprotected settlers on the frontier of Pennsylvania and Virginia. Worried and angry warriors stood around fires that lighted the area in an orange glow, and the sounds of shouting echoed across the water. Kilbuck watched carefully and was much dismayed at the jugs of rum now being passed among the many warriors. He despised such gifts and feared the effect on his warriors. Those who willingly drank themselves into a stupor would never be welcome on his raids. He made a mental note of those who resisted the temptation. At a place of prominence in front of the French officers, the chiefs stood, arms crossed on their bare chests, and blankets hung over one shoulder. Shingis and Kilbuck listened to the French, but spoke in Delaware to each other. "Braddock is dead with over 400 of his soldiers. They were defeated by the Indians, who have already aligned themselves with the French. They do not know how to fight us. They brought 50 women with them, but only 4 survive. It is a great loss for the English. Now we are ready and have our sign." Shingis was firm as he told his followers his decision. His words were followed by shouts and yells and the raising of tomahawks toward the east. In the midst of the confusion, a French officer approached Kilbuck and said, "Chief Kilbuck, our brother, you have lived among the English and know their language and ways. You must prepare your warriors to raid the frontier and take as many scalps as possible. We will pay you well for them." Pushing any doubt aside, Kilbuck smiled and knew that great things were expected of him. He looked at the faces of the warriors who surrounded him and knew that they would follow him anywhere. A week passed before Kilbuck and Shingis met at Logstown, still an active trading village on the beautiful river, full of French traders and Indians from various tribes in the Ohio Valley. Word had spread of a great council, and representatives of Ohio tribes were in attendance. All believed that the time had come for the French alliance. The two chiefs walked slowly along the muddy path leading through the village, while inhabitants looked suspiciously at the imposing men. Sounds of French, English, and Indian dialects echoed throughout the noisy village. Distrusting the whites, Kilbuck would watch for signs, and knew that the Great Spirit was angry at the destruction of the land and the needless killing of its creatures. Whites often kill for pleasure, not sustenance, as did his people. It was wrong, he knew. Despite misgivings about the French, Kilbuck put those thoughts into the back of his mind. "It begins, brother. We will begin our destruction of these white devils and hope for success." Shingis stopped and looked at Kilbuck, waiting for his response. "Yes, brother. I will take the scalps of as many white men as I can. But there are many, perhaps too many. Our people will die at their hands also. Yes, that is a part of life, and we cannot stop it. We must hope that the Great Spirit is with us on our journey." And so began the terror. Shingis and Kilbuck and others began to raid Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Virginia. The settlers could not hide from the clever raiding parties who managed to appear and disappear, killing and capturing settlers at will. The French paid well for the scalps, and the tribes rejoiced at the captives who replaced their lost loved ones. Chapter 3. The summer of 1755 continued with an increase in raids, and settlers as far away as Maryland feared for their lives. Later that year, Kilbuck and his warriors headed to the Virginia colony and the south branch of the Potomac River, an area Kilbuck knew well. They sought isolated settlers in lone cabins where they often managed to kill the adults and take children as captives. Kilbuck lost few warriors and proceeded carefully during these raids. His successes were well known, and he was greatly feared by those who lived on the frontier. During the spring of 1756, using trickery, two of Kilbuck's warriors lured Captain John Mercer and his men into an ambush near Cacapon River, where Kilbuck and the rest of the party waited. Mercer was killed along with 16 of his men, and this clever and violent act helped establish Kilbuck's status. Within days, the war party attacked the settlers of Patterson Creek, 9 miles from Fort Pleasant, where they killed Vincent Williams, who was subsequently quartered, and his head stuck on a post as a warning to the determined settlers. Kilbuck had no sympathy for Williams, who had remained alone to defend his isolated cabin in an act of arrogance and stupidity. During the next 3 years, Kilbuck and Shingis continued to carry out raids, terrorizing both Pennsylvania and Virginia settlers. Their targets were isolated cabins deep in the forest, or settlers traveling in small groups and boats floating unprotected down rivers. Shingis became known as Shingis the Terrible, and the British put a price on both warriors' heads. The Indians' hate for the British settlers increased, and both vowed to rid the land of the white devils. Shingis relinquished his role as principal chief, and the well-respected Netawatwees now headed the clan, while Shingis concentrated on his raids as his reputation increased. The war with its killings on both sides continued, and the French called yet another great council at Fort Duquesne in April 1758. On this chilly night, Kilbuck and his followers, both Shawnee and Delaware, sat around a fire, listening to several French officers outline a plan of attacks upon the English settlements when the weather improved. The French promised guidance, supplies, and manpower as usual. But Kilbuck's mind wandered as he listened to various officers drone on and on about the British, their forts, their land-grabbing claims, and the numerous settlers who, despite danger, continued to move westward, paying no attention to Indian treaties. He had heard it before, of course, but he kept his promises and had assured the French of his attendance at this great council. Kilbuck never paid any attention to the speakers unless they spoke his native language, so he waited for the interpreter. It was a matter of pride and cleverness. The French explained, "My red brothers, the British must be stopped so that we can secure our trade routes and trade with our brothers, the Indians, the true owners of the land." The French entreaties were all too familiar by now, and many warriors feared the British were winning. Although Kilbuck knew he was clever, he also knew that numbers mattered. The uncontrollable British settlers continued to increase, more moving westward every day, and showed no signs of letting up. In comparison, the Indians were small in numbers. In his heart, he feared no effort would be enough to stop the surge of whites, and he feared his people were doomed, regardless of efforts he might make.
"Kill 2 settlers and 4 more appear to take their places," Kilbuck had warned.
Now spring had come, and it was time to resume the raids. Kilbuck and 60 men were to head to Augusta County, attack the 2 forts, kill and scalp the militia, and capture desirable settlers. Others headed to Pennsylvania for the same purpose. The plan was the same, only the targets were different. Annihilate the settlers so that they could not produce more men to continue their encroachment of Indian land and kill Indians. French intelligence had recently discovered that Fort Upper Tract was garrisoned by Virginia militia. How many men was not known, but the fort presented a target for the taking of many scalps. Another fort, several miles to the southeast, probably held many local settlers, allowing the possibility of captives, who the French knew would be a further enticement for the Indian warriors. Familiar with the valleys, Kilbuck was ready. Only a month before this night, Kilbuck had sent his loyal disciple, White Otter, and others to Virginia, where they successfully raided several remote areas and returned with horses and young captives. Additionally, they had knowledge of the new forts. White Owl had reported, "My chief, we can take these English forts easily. The garrison is small, and the eastern fort has no militia. The English cannot withstand our attacks. The spirits will aid us."
"Ah, that is good news, brother. I, too, have seen signs of our success," answered Kilbuck. He had begun to believe that the raids were slowing down the settlers.
At the conclusion of the French entreaties, Kilbuck stood near the fire, watching the gathered warriors perform their war dance, illuminated by firelight under a fleeting moon. The night became a nightmare of human shapes with raised tomahawks, gesturing toward the east, the noise of chanting, the beating of drums, and the shrieks of war cries, while the French quietly distributed rum to the now crazed Indians. And so the night progressed as Kilbuck, avoiding rum, pulled his hand-picked followers aside and removed them from the chaotic scene. He instructed, "Prepare your weapons and be ready to leave at first light. The spirits are with us on this journey. You must not drink the French rum, for it will destroy us." Kilbuck was confident and planned to leave at the first light of dawn for the trip to the South Branch area. 9 days later, dozens of painted warriors lay hidden in the trees and rocks as close to Fort Upper Tract as possible without the risk of observance. The Indians had encountered only one man during their trip, and they dispatched him easily, hiding his remains in the deep forest. Kilbuck was pleased that the Great Spirit was with them on this important mission. He felt the water spirits and saw the sign of the eagle, but he entrusted his token to White Otter.
"If I die, you must take my token to my son, who will have need of it." He feared for his son, Yellowlamond, now the successor to Netawatwees.
The waiting war party watched a young soldier open the fort gate, relieve himself, and stretch out for a morning nap. They noticed the gate position and could not believe their good luck. Thinking the spirits were with them today, Kilbuck ordered 2 warriors to subdue the soldier. The young soldier never knew what hit him, and lost his scalp before a minute had lapsed, eyes closed and blood flowing over his face. 4 warriors then made their way to the gate, stationing themselves on either side, with one motioning the others, hidden in the forest, to come forward. At Kilbuck's signal, the war party rushed the gate and entered the fort. The sun was high when the fort's inhabitants finally lay dead or dying, while the crazed warriors tore through everything, securing weapons, food, rum, and whatever useful items they could carry, while others scalped and secured the grimly remnants on their waists or their spears. Kilbuck watched in silence until he observed a warrior fighting a strong soldier, the leader of the group. In seconds, Kilbuck grabbed his warrior, pushed him aside, and fell upon the wounded captain. The struggle was brief before Kilbuck brought his tomahawk down on the man's skull. He then removed the scalp and attached it to his spear.
"You will kill no more warriors, and will have no more sons to continue the killing," he shouted.
Kilbuck watched for several minutes, and then ordered several warriors to place hot embers by the wooden stockade and blockhouse, and feed the fire until the flames began to climb the logs. A slight breeze encouraged the slow-burning wood until the entire structure began to smoke and flame in earnest. The bodies had been piled next to the wooden blockhouse, which also was ignited, and it was not long until the crackling and roar of the uncontrollable burning was heard. It was with great satisfaction that Kilbuck and his war party watched from the nearby trail as the fort's flames rose high above the trees, while the smoke billowed above, hindering the view of the clear blue April sky. Some held their noses in an attempt to escape the odious smells of burning flesh now permeating the area. Their eyes became reddened and burned. The warriors, after a brief rest, moved to the Indian trail to move on to their second target, Fort Siebert, 9 miles southeast. They were bloody and exhausted, yet the group planned to move to at least within 2 miles of the fort. For 7 difficult miles, Kilbuck led his warriors quietly toward the second target, Fort Siebert. They saw several cabins, devoid of human life, for their owners had left perhaps weeks before. They did not stop to burn these reminders of encroachment. They had 22 scalps, a goodly number for payment from the French, and they would soon have more. Kilbuck was hopeful that he could secure captives, young whites who would replace Indian family members who had died or been killed. Captured women, too, would be valuable because the French paid handsomely for female slaves. By late afternoon, the Indians were comfortably established off the trail in a hollow near a small stream where they rested, cleaned their weapons, munched on jerky, and prepared themselves for tomorrow's task. Some cleaned the scalps, while others repaired their war paint. Darkness filled the area by 7, and the Indians rested and talked quietly. Guards were posted in case some hapless settler might be out after dark, but the possibility was remote these days. It was cool and damp as the sun disappeared, and the Indians slept early to awake at first light of dawn. Kilbuck could not sleep, and thought of the raids he had led and the deaths he had caused. He knew that the Great Spirit approved, because it was the only way to stop the whites. The next morning, 60 painted Shawnee and Delaware warriors moved single file, silently, toward Fort Siebert, under the cover of heavy fog that hung over the Black Forest. It was early, some light filtering through the mist, when the war party stopped at a signal from Kilbuck, 1 mile from their destination, which stood 300 yards beyond the bank of the South Fork branch of the Potomac River. Blending in with the trees, the Indian silently observed a lone man kneeling on a rise. Flint Rock pointed toward a doe feeding in a small glen in the distance. Kilbuck sent 2 warriors toward him, and in minutes they returned with a bloody scalp. Minutes later, 2 warriors returned with a woman and a boy who had been heard nearby and had no warning of the impending attack. Kilbuck ordered the boy to be killed, but allowed the woman to remain as a captive, held securely by White Owl, pleased at his new responsibility. At a bend of the trail, the wooden fort, framed in mist and fog, loomed ahead on a rise several 100 yards west of the river. Since the fog had begun to lift and expose the cleared, flat area, the Indians would be seen if they tried a frontal attack. Behind the fort, a ravine provided natural protection. The war party stopped to secrete themselves in the boulders and the brush by the river. A spring lay exposed about 20 yards from the fort's gate. Surveying the situation, the warriors waited for a command from their leader, who had brazenly crept close to the spring, where he could not be seen due to a depression in the cleared ground. The Great Spirit was with them, thought Kilbuck as he lay on his stomach observing the silent fort. Then a shot rang out, and Kilbuck saw a warrior fall into the river and another slide to the ground. A shot from the fort had hit its mark, and Kilbuck watched his warrior drift down the slowly moving river, feathers floating with him. The shot had passed through the dead man into another warrior who was severely wounded, but could be taken by litter back to the Ohio River villages. He knew it was time to move quickly because he feared that the militia might return and did not want to lose another warrior. Moving back to his waiting warriors, Kilbuck directed them to initiate rapid firing at the fort. For more than 15 minutes, a barrage of bullets and arrows hit the walls of the log fort in rapid succession. The settlers, having taken defensive positions, returned the fire, to no avail. The firing ceased as suddenly as it had begun. Kilbuck made his way slowly across the flat area toward the fort. Holding his rifle in a ready position, he stood his ground and waited for someone to open the gate and take a few steps toward him. Knowing that time was of the essence, Kilbuck intended to promise anything the settlers wanted, but would keep none of them.
"Hear me," shouted Kilbuck. He paused and then continued. "Listen to my words. We will not harm you if you surrender. What say you?"
A fearful settler opened the gate and walked slowly toward Kilbuck. He and the chief began to negotiate, their voices loud and harsh. Slowly, but firmly, Kilbuck spoke.
"We are at war with the English and will give you no quarter unless you surrender. I have come with 60 of my warriors to warn all settlers that they must return to the east or face the wrath of my people. We will take this fort as we have taken others, and we will show no mercy if you do not surrender."
Changing his tone to a conciliatory one, Kilbuck added, "But do not fear, for we will take you to the trail that leads across the mountains to safety."
"How can we trust your words?" the spokesman replied, and angrily added, "You did not spare our neighbors when you raided this area a month ago. You murdered our friends in cold blood with no mercy. You have taken our women and children. Why should I expect your words to be truthful?"
Containing his fury, Kilbuck continued,
"Have my people not been the victims of the white man's treachery? Have you not made promises and violated treaty after treaty? Have you not encroached upon our hunting grounds and depleted our food supply? Have we not lost young men to your soldiers? Do not question my words. You will have to believe me as we have to believe your people," voiced Kilbuck, his steely eyes unflinching. "You have our terms. Do not be foolish. We are strong and will succeed. Now give me your answer. My warriors are restless, and you have already killed one of them. I will not lose more."
"I must take your words to my people, and then I will give you our answer," answered the man, and he turned quickly to enter the stockade. Kilbuck waited for 10 minutes for the man to return, while his warriors waited anxiously. Finally, the gate opened, and the fort's leader reluctantly surrendered the fort, much to Kilbuck's relief. He ordered his warriors not to kill, but rather round up the terrified settlers and line them up in front of the fort, and then he would decide what to do with them. Several women and children ran past him as they ran to the river. His warriors paid no attention, and he did not want to take time to pursue a handful of escapees. Chapter 4. Before the final act of the burning of the fort, Kilbuck ordered the captives to line up in front of the gate, each person attached to a warrior, some bound by their wrists and some with ropes around their necks. Then he ordered embers to be placed next to the fort's walls. With hand signals and a glare, Kilbuck brought his war party to a kind of order while smoke thickened and the fort began to burn in earnest. Most settlers, watching their last sight of their home for several days, slowed their outrage and cries to whimpers, waiting for the next disaster. Kilbuck spoke to the group.
"No crying," he warned. "Indian children do not cry. Silence your children, and they may live."
Knowing that white children would not cease their cries, he intended to make an example of them. He knew they would not live on the difficult trip back to the Ohio River. Signaling their captors, he ordered their slaughter. With no hesitation, the three warriors holding the three small children grabbed their hair and, pulling upward, used their knives to scalp the helpless crying children, who died quickly, covered with blood, mourned by all settlers watching, many of whom shed uncontrollable tears. Killbuck watched the crying women and the speechless children in silence.
"Do they not know that their children now live with the spirits and will no longer suffer?"
Within an hour, the trip up the mountain began, when suddenly Killbuck ordered a stop. Motioning to his warriors, he ordered two logs to be situated 10 feet apart, and the captives to be seated on them. It was he who indicated who was to sit where. The action took several minutes, and when it was done, the older children sat on one log, while the adults and small children were pulled to the other.
"We will rest," Killbuck said, and then pointed at three adult women.
They were roughly pulled from the log and pushed to the other side. The captives, now divided into two groups, knew that those on one log would survive, and those on the other would live but a few more minutes. The warriors wanted the bloody business completed, so they could return home with their contraband and their captives. Killbuck gave the signal, and his warriors carried out their gruesome task while one of the saved women fell prone on the ground. She had fainted at the sound of the tomahawk on her father's skull, much to the concern of the warriors. White Owl breathed a sigh of relief and said, "Brothers, we cannot kill this woman. Her spirit is powerful and can leave her body to do us harm. We must not take her life." The warriors murmured ahs and stood in reverence above her inert form. Quickly, White Owl jerked her up and shook her to consciousness. The woman's eyes opened in horror, and she started to scream, but a fierce look from White Owl silenced her. He glared at his comrades. Argument ensued, but White Owl was adamant. She must be saved. Her soul could do them no harm. Killbuck waited for several seconds before he agreed. She was, after all, a redhead whom he admired. He knew White Owl desired her, but she would be his if he wanted. He did not want to allow her spirit to interfere with his mission. The massacre had taken less than an hour, and now the survivors were to continue their march. Monotonous hours of marching continued on narrow paths up and over steep hills and deep into the lush green mountains. It was close to sunset, even though the sun had hidden itself the better part of the long day. Killbuck was proud of his choice in captives, for they all marched well, seemed physically fit, and did not exhibit hysteria that he had sometimes seen in captives. He was not devoid of compassion and was well aware of the terror within the minds of the captives. He had no hate for those whom he slaughtered. It was simply a matter of necessity. These captives would adjust to Indian life, much preferable to their harsh lives as settlers. Several days later, the war party and their prisoners reached the Monongahela River, where canoes were hidden for the crossing. The process had only begun when a thunderous roar caused everyone to gaze at the western sky. All watched in awe as the sun disappeared, and a huge black cloud passed above them. Millions of crying birds, passenger pigeons darkening the sky in their passage. The captives had never seen such a sight, but the warriors had, and looked in amazement at nature's bounty, taking the passage of the birds as a good sign. Killbuck smiled as he watched the sight, and knew he had done well. Chapter 5. After 9 days, the warriors and their miserable captives crossed the beautiful river and entered Logstown. Killbuck and his men lodged for several days among the French and Indians who lived in the trading village. It was a triumphant homecoming, celebrated by much rum drinking and dancing, and Killbuck received both goods and ammunition for his success. He also made plans to take the redhead to Sawtunk as his wife. He had become very fond of her spirit, but knew he was an old man in her eyes. He approached the situation delicately.
"Madam," he said in English, "I wish to take you to my village to learn about you and your people." "Do what you will with me," she answered in an angry voice. "You have taken the lives of my parents and others. Do you not know that I hate you? You will soon forget your white life and embrace the life of my people. It may be preferable to your life as a frontier wife."
"Never will I forget my people. How can you live with their deaths on your bloody hands?
Woman, do you not know that your white soldiers have killed and scalped my people? Why is it different? It is a part of life. Why does your God favor the whites over the red man? I do not think the God of all the earth prefers the white man. It is the whites who destroy his creation, not the Indians. It was your people who brought disease and death to thousands of the Indians who lived in this land near the great water for generations without the taint of the whites and their diseases. It is your people who kill our food supply wantonly and waste nature's bounty. I must make up for your large numbers by preventing your men from siring more children to fight us. We are in a death struggle. You are arrogant to believe that your people are superior.
You cannot turn me against my people. My parents were good people and worked hard. They had no hate for your people. They did not march against them like the British soldiers did.
She lowered her tear-stained face. Yes, they were brave and died noble deaths. I had no hate for them. But I have a duty to save our ancestral lands for my descendants. Not yours. You will come to my village to live with other captives, most of whom have adjusted to our life.
He turned away from her, knowing that she would never accept him, and he would not force an unwanted liaison.
It was done. He would take no more wives, and he would lead no more raids.
By fall of that year, Fort Duquesne had fallen to the British, and the Indians soon abandoned the French cause. They were wary, however, as they watched the British rebuild the fort and call it Fort Pitt, hastily erected on the embers of the fallen French structure. The British assured them it was only temporary. The British began their attempts to gain Indian loyalty and called a great council at the new fort. Hundreds of Indians attended the meeting where the British distributed supplies and promises. As he listened, Kilbuck sarcastically said, "Brothers, our new masters do not sound different from our old ones." In October, the British and Delaware chiefs met at Easton, Pennsylvania, where they signed a treaty known as the Treaty of Easton. The British returned the land west of the Alleghenies to the Indians, and in return the Indians would not support the French and put down their arms. The French and Indian War was over. Kilbuck and his son Gelaleman, Shingus, and other representatives of the Ohio tribes returned to their villages with feelings of uncertainty. Unhappy at the forced peace, Shingus was wary and angry as ever and looked for other ways to continue his fight against the white settlers. He and his family had been forced to move to Coshocton in the Ohio country, where the British had destroyed Katanning 2 years before.
"Come with me, brother. It is time for you and your clan to cross the Ohio and join our brothers in Coshocton."
"Brother, I do not wish to see you go. I have seen over 40 winters, but will remain here. I know that our days are numbered, and I too will be forced to move west. I do not trust these British, and fear they might try to detain us for our destruction of their people."
"No, they do not wish to anger our people. They will not detain us or the others. They will bribe us with gifts so that we will turn from the French. They want our land and will stop at nothing to get it. They will ply our warriors with rum and make us dependent on the burning liquor and their evil gifts. I will never give up and hope to find others who feel the same way. Come with me, brother."
"I will miss you, friend, but I must stand with my son. I fear he will need me." The two warriors looked at each other for a minute before they embraced, and turned from each other to be swallowed up by a crowd of warriors outside the new fort. Kilbuck knew that they might not see each other again, and he felt the burden of eternal sadness.
Chapter 6.
Chief Nattawatwees kept his clan in Sawtunk for 2 more years, while Kilbuck remained with his son, Gelaleman, designated to succeed Nattawatwees, whose wife was Kilbuck's sister, the line of matriarchal succession. Kilbuck feared for his son, who lacked the fire in his belly that was necessary to combat the British. Nattawatwees, too, was a peaceful man, and Kilbuck worried about the fate of his people. The redhead he had once desired had escaped back to her people, and the French relinquished their claims in the Ohio Valley. Now the British turned the other way as the settlers continued to push farther west, regardless of treaties. Summoned by the British to Fort Detroit after the fall of Montreal, the Delaware were eagerly sought out. Nattawatwees, Shingas, and Kilbuck attended and met with the British conquerors who desired their cooperation and needed passage through the Tuscarawas Valley in Ohio. The Delaware were tired of war and accepted the British proposals without question, and soon returned to Coshocton, now the principal Delaware village in the valley. In the summer of 1762, Kilbuck returned to Coshocton at Shingas's request for the funeral of his wife. Shingas himself had been ill but recovered. His wife did not, and it was thought that evil spirits had invaded her body and took her from Shingas. The funeral lasted hours, and Kilbuck and the other chiefs sat silently next to the coffin that had been lowered into the ground, while the women wailed in mourning for the loss of this woman. The chiefs then followed behind Shingas, all dressed in full regalia, as was the custom, as he walked away from the corpse so that her spirit could find peace. Later, the chiefs, along with relatives and friends, crowded into Shingas's lodge, where he presented many with gifts from his wife's possessions. After several hours, the chiefs were left alone. Another force, Neolan, a Delaware spiritual leader, began to speak of the signs given to him about his people. He was certain that the Delaware could only survive if they followed their ancestral ways and gave up the white man's gifts. "Return to our old ways. Beware of the liquor. Give up your muskets and return to the bow and arrow." Chief Pontiac, the great Ottawa chief, is organizing a confederation in the north to move against the British, and hopes that our French brothers will continue the fight. But he will not give up his arms and return to our ancestral ways. It will be a mistake, brothers. Shingas stood before Neolan. "Brother, you are wrong. We cannot defeat our enemies without arms. The bow and arrow cannot overcome the white man's guns. Pontiac knows that, but he also knows we must give up the liquor that is destroying our people." Kilbuck added, "Our young men want to follow Pontiac, but the French may not aid our cause, and he will fall. Our nation is splitting apart, and there will be many who will not fight, and we will be divided." Shingas glared at Kilbuck and Neolan. "I will fight. I will take my sons and join Pontiac by the next moon. My wife's death was a sign. We must confront the evil spirits that hide in the British, or all will be lost." Kilbuck lowered his eyes and said no more. He knew Shingas would fight, but he would not. He would return to his son and Nattawatwees in the morning. "My son," Kilbuck said several weeks later, as he and his son finished skinning a doe that Gelaleman had shot that morning, "I fear that your sympathies lie with the British, our enemies. You cannot trust them." "Father, I no longer see things through your eyes. Our only hope lies with them. They will soon overrun this valley, and we must show them loyalty, or they will forsake and destroy us." "Pontiac may prevail, you know," Kilbuck replied softly, knowing the odds were against the Indians. "I think not. The British will defeat Pontiac. Nattawatwees has seen signs." "You must choose wisely, my son. Look for your own signs. Pontiac has already taken several British forts in the north. He may be on his way to take Fort Pitt." "The fort will never fall. The British have too many soldiers, and the Indians have few supplies and men." "Shingas fights with Pontiac. He will die before surrendering, you know."
Shingus is a great warrior and will die honorably, but he will be defeated with Pontiac. The new year, 1763, began with an uproar. Pontiac had destroyed several British forts. Now he and his angry warriors held Fort Pitt under siege while the British waited for reinforcements. Kilbuck waited for news as the Delaware remained neutral except for a few of their warriors with Shingus. Days passed, but the Indians could not take the fort, and food and ammunition became scarce. Colonel Bouquet was on his way with a large force to aid the fort, so warriors began to drift back to their villages in despair and starvation. Then a decision was made. The tribes would sue for peace, because they could no longer maintain the siege without help from the French. Sir Geoffrey Amherst, the commander of Fort Pitt, called another great council at the British fort. He promised food and supplies if the Indians would return to their villages and put down their arms. Kilbuck attended the council with Nettawatwees and his son, as thousands of warriors camped outside the fort while negotiations were completed. Kilbuck, who no longer had a say in the proceedings, watched and searched the group for familiar faces. On the second day, he saw him, Shingus, still tall, strong, and dignified, aged but little.
"Shingus, brother,"
shouted Kilbuck as he shoved his way through warriors to reach his friend.
"It is with great pleasure we meet again."
"Ah, Kilbuck, the Great Spirit has allowed us to see each other again. It is a good sign." Shingus embraced Kilbuck warmly.
"For us, today, but there are no signs for our people, I fear. But you have fared well with Pontiac, and have kept your life while the great chief has fled to Indiana territory."
"Yes, but we are hated by these usurpers. They would kill me if they could. Amherst is a bad man. He hates us, and will treat us like conquered people, not equals. The British will send us home with gifts today, but will take them away tomorrow. There will be peace, but we will have no choice, and the whites will continue to take our lands and push us deep into the Ohio country. It is a sad day for us, brother."
"I fear you speak the truth, but let us enjoy what time we have, friend."
The two warriors, one old and tired and the other younger but weathered and hard, walk side by side away from the noisy crowd to renew their friendship and enjoy what time they might have. The following year, 1764, Kilbuck heard the news. Shingus was dead of the pox. Amherst had gifted the Indians blankets, and some believed that these items were infected with smallpox. Kilbuck thought it was true. It had happened before. He believed Amherst was evil, and would stop at nothing to rid himself of the Indian threat. Captain Pipe, a very able and hardened warrior, began to agree with Kilbuck, and would fight again if necessary. Pontiac's actions had angered the British, who decided to confront the problem head-on, regardless of previous treaties. Kilbuck heard that Captain Bouquet's great army that had assembled at Fort Pitt before marching into the Ohio country would stop at nothing to subdue them, and soon settled camp on the Tuscarawas River deep into the Ohio country, where Bouquet demanded all white captives be returned in the summer. When the Shawnee began to return the first captives, Bouquet said, "You have shown yourselves people who can no longer be relied on. It is now in your power to save yourselves if you abide by our orders." Red Hawk, the Shawnee spokesman, answered for all when he said, "We now wipe away everything bad between us. Let us think no more of war. We, who are warriors, may forget our disputes, and will come to Fort Pitt in the spring with the remainder of our prisoners." He handed Bouquet a wampum belt. "Bury with this belt all the bones of the people that have been killed during the unhappy war which the evil spirit has occasioned among us." When he heard the news, Kilbuck briefly thought of all the whites he had brought to Indian villages to replace family members, and he knew there would be many who would want to stay with their Indian families. As the captives trickled into the army's headquarters, Kilbuck heard the stories.
He knew of the tears of the squaws who brought their white daughters and sons to the soldiers who would escort them to Fort Pitt. He knew of the white captives who refused to go back and hid in the villages. He heard of the white boys who had to be chained in order to stay with the soldiers. And he felt great sadness when he thought of the half-breed children who would never be a part of either world. The next year, 1765, another treaty was signed at Fort Sandwich, New York, at Johnson Hall, the home of the well-respected Indian agent William Johnson. Kilbuck made the long journey with Nettawatwees and his son. He was now 54 and felt his years, but he would not be dissuaded from accompanying the group making the trip. The treaty was signed and was a repeat of the proclamation of 1763. The whites were to stop coming over the Alleghenies to claim Indian land, and the Indians must put down their arms. They would still come, and nothing would stop them, illegal or not. Johnson was a fair man, but he could not stop the white migrations. No one could now, Kilbuck thought. Kilbuck addressed the Delaware chiefs who assembled to sign the treaty. The whites will not honor this treaty. They will come and cut down trees everywhere, and by another will come, and then a fort will be built for protection, and the land will be claimed by whites. We will move to Ohio this spring. We will spend no more winters in Sawtuck, too close to the whites. It is time, and the signs are there. Nettawatwees spoke quietly to Kilbuck as the two men began their trip home. I agree. It is time. The whites are too numerous, and our food supply is scarce. They will come and take our lands. Yes, you are right. They will still come, but we cannot fight them and must join them instead, in order to survive. A sad look spread over Kilbuck's face as he knew the truth of Nettawatwee's words and the plight of his people. Chapter 7. It was 1770, and Kilbuck felt his 60 years as he watched Nettawatwee's, who was older by many winters. He marveled at the old man's stamina and wished he had been favored. His eyesight was failing, and he hated at the loss. He could no longer shoot an arrow with the skill he had earlier possessed. Kilbuck supported his son, the successor, but he could not rid himself of his hatred for the British. There would never be peace, he thought, until the Indians were defeated entirely. The new village of Newcomerstown near Coshocton in Ohio prospered. Nettawatwees became known as Newcomer by the whites, and the name persisted for the new village. The Delaware kept an uneasy peace, while the warriors in Coshocton enjoyed as much rum as they could obtain, and nights in the village were filled with drinking and dancing with no thought to the future. Soon Moravian missionaries appeared and sought to build a mission and convert the Delaware to Christianity, as they had done in Pennsylvania. They were concerned about the path the Delaware were taking and sought to correct it. Nettawatwees listened carefully to the story of the whites' Jesus and the forgiveness of their God, while Kilbuck and War Chief Pipe remained indifferent to the missionary's speeches. Speaking with Captain Pipe, Kilbuck reported, "Our chief seems willing to allow the missionaries a plot of land near our village. They intend to convert our people from our ancestral spirits to the white man's God. Do you think they will succeed?" "I don't know, but I will have none of their gods. Nettawatwees has told me to lay out a plot of land for them, and I will reluctantly do so. They do not wish to live too close to our village, for they hate the drunkenness that they see there. These peaceful missionaries are not our enemies, but our people need to have hope, and perhaps they will provide us hope. Nettawatwees hopes the missionaries can rid our people of the pox that is killing many." Kilbuck rubbed his eyes, hating the dimness that sometimes occurred. "I do not fear them, Kilbuck. I fear only that they will bring more whites into our land. That is not acceptable." The two men ceased their conversation when Kilbuck noticed a man walking toward them. He recognized Simon Girty, a former white captive who had willingly given his loyalty to the Indians. He scouted and fought for them with no regrets. His heart lay with the Indians. He had intense hatred for the Americans and suspected the Moravians were spies for the British. Gertie strode to the men with fire in his eyes.
Captain Pipe, I must advise you as war chief, drive these Moravians from your land. If you follow my advice, you will get more scalps hanging from your belt. Do not allow them to convert your people.
Gertie, what brings you to our village?
Laughed Captain Pipe, who stood a head taller than the wiry, buckskin-clad man who showed no humor in his stern face.
I come with a warning. The British are devious, and their spies are everywhere. They will come soon to take the Ohio country. You must be wary. Join the Shawnee and the Wyandots in defeating our enemies.
You may be right, but for now I will do as Netawatwi asks. He is our chief, and I must obey him. For now. Pipe's eyes narrowed to slits. Killbuck said nothing but watched Gertie and noted his small black eyes and lined face. He did not trust him and saw the hatred that simmered beneath Gertie's passive face. Captain Pipe grabbed Gertie's arm.
Come, join Killbuck and me for a meal and a smoke.
Gertie allowed himself to be led into the main lodge by Pipe, with Killbuck following, wondering at Pipe's easy acceptance of this devious man. For several years, two of the missionaries remained near the village and established their mission while the Delaware considered their message. Some converted and embraced the word of God, and some even took biblical names such as Abraham and Noah. They learned hymns of praise and embraced them. The missionaries gave them hope where there was none. But many continued to look warily upon these white men of God. One morning, a lone man rode into the village and asked permission to preach the gospel among neighboring villages. It was Killbuck who said firmly,
"No, we must not allow this. We know our Moravians, but we do not know this man. The Delaware are already divided on many things. We cannot allow more division. We must not allow this man to stir up those who are suspicious of our Moravians who have done no harm."
Netawatwi's listened.
"Perhaps you are right. The whites are fighting among themselves. The settlers no longer trust the English father across the great water. Soon the settlers will flow into the Ohio country with no regard for the British soldiers or their laws. They have paid little attention to the English treaties."
Angrily, Killbuck said, "I trust no white. I do not like the Moravians, who are harmless but have divided our people. This man must be sent back. We need no more distractions, my chief."
The Reverend Jones did not preach. The next few years saw further encroachment by the whites and rage by the various Indian tribes north of the Ohio River. Their sacred Kentucky lands were being settled by ambitious whites who defied the treaties and began to come down the Ohio in flatboats. Warriors began to carry out raids into the Kentucky lands, and unrest magnified. Small settlements popped up in the Kentucky interior, and there was no stopping them. Killbuck sometimes feared for his two daughters, who now lived on the frontier with their chosen white husbands, against the advice of both Killbuck and others. Chapter 8. Now war intensified all across the Ohio Valley in 1774. A great battle had been fought at Point Pleasant, where the Kanawha River empties into the Great Ohio. The volunteer army of local militia units under Andrew Lewis had been left to fight the Indians alone while the British general, Lord Dunmore, hesitated north of the river. Many believe that Dunmore deliberately arranged for Lewis's army to fight alone, hoping that it would be defeated. Dunmore was aware that the angry Indians had had enough, and that warriors from many tribes were on their way to surprise Lewis's forces on a small point of land on the south side of the Ohio. The violent clash left no clear winner, and both sides claimed victory. Lewis was furious, and the sparks of revolution were ignited. A day after the battle, an excited Shawnee on a lathered horse rode through the village, a scalp flying from his spear.
"We defeated the Long Knives from Virginia. We could have buried them all, but word came that another force was close at hand. We left, never turning our backs on them.
We lost only a few warriors, but their losses were great. Buxinwa, our great chief, lost his wife, but we will have revenge. As Kilbuck had observed earlier, the settlers finally broke from their English father and declared independence. The country was in turmoil. Released to the Americans after the French and Indian War ended, Fort Pitt now was held by soldiers with allegiance to the colonists, while the English king's men organized their armies in the east. Kilbuck watched events unfold and feared for his people, once again caught in a web between two superior forces. But this time, Kilbuck knew many would fight, and the question was with which side. By 1776, the colonists officially declared their independence from the British father. It was not long until a council was called at Fort Pitt, where the Indians gathered to pledge their allegiance to the Americans. Many did not attend, and Kilbuck feared they would join the French and fight brother against brother. Again, Kilbuck was conflicted, but finally decided that the hope of the Delaware lay with the settlers, not a British father across the great water. Nettawatwees and his son joined the Indians at Fort Pitt, but Nettawatwees was old and tired. He had become a Christian because of the influence of the missionaries and was pleased that an afterlife with God lay ahead. He was ill, very old and sick, and Kilbuck knew that he had lived almost 100 winters, a phenomenal feat for a man. Gelaleyman would succeed, but Kilbuck feared he was not ready, nor did he seem to have a fire in his belly for his people. White Eyes, a renowned and respected warrior, waited quietly, but intended to replace Gelaleyman in the eyes of the Delaware. During the council at Fort Pitt, Nettawatwees was unable to participate and lay outside the fort for a day before he closed his eyes and said, "My people, follow the word of God, the true God of all mankind. Your salvation lies with him, not our ancestral gods." His eyes closed, and his face took on a look of peace. Several Delaware warriors stood over the body, moans emitting from their mouths. White Eyes glared at Gelaleyman, waiting for his words. Fear spread across the successor's face as he realized the enormity of his task. The Delawares were divided. Some wanted the white man's god, while others wanted to wage war against the steadily arriving white settlers. Kilbuck watched his son in silence. He had seen over 65 winters now, and was very tired and saddened by loss. Gelaleyman said, "Brothers, our great chief has risen to heaven, the place where he will find peace and unite with our ancestors. We will support these Americans who have promised us supplies and protection." Captain Pipe watched and knew that the influence of the peaceful Nettawatwees was over, and that he could influence the Delaware in making war. Gelaleyman could not stop the flow of the warriors who hated the Americans. It was a sad, mournful group who returned to Newcomerstown after burying their chief near the fort. In the days that followed, Kilbuck watched the powerful sub-chief White Eyes take control of many of the unhappy Delaware. A small number remained with the missionaries, but the division of the two sides was great. Although Gelaleyman was in line to succeed the old chief, White Eyes prevailed but favored the Americans. One day, Gelaleyman found Kilbuck seated within his lodge, resting after a midday meal. He now lived with his sister's daughter and her warrior husband, who provided for his needs, since he could no longer hunt. "Father," said Gelaleyman, "you know of the raids that the Shawnee and a few of our people are conducting in the Kentucky land. Many settlers have been killed and horses stolen. This has caused much unrest."
"Yes, I have heard. It is not good, son. The whites are too many, and more will come. It will never end."
"I fear you are right, but the raids will not stop as long as the Long Knives continue to take the land. I have sad news to tell you."
"Ah, that is why I see a sad look on your face, my son.
Our sister, Miotoka, the squaw of John Schoolcraft, the Virginia white settler, has been murdered along with 7 of her children, your grandchildren, by a raiding party of Shawnee.
Kilbuck remained silent for a minute until a pained look spread across his weathered face. Then he cried out in anger and grief, while Gelaleman held his shoulder.
"No, it cannot be. It cannot be. The seed of my loins, my grandchildren, gone, gone. It is the wrath of the Great Spirit. It is my punishment for the lives I have taken. It is on my shoulders. My fault."
"No, father, it is not your fault. Miotoka chose to marry the white man despite the objections of our people. You warned her that it might end badly, but she would not listen. She was too enthralled by the attention of the settler. She was young, only 13, but did not listen. 3 of her children still live, and 1 was taken by the Shawnee." Kilbuck's face took on a strange expression.
"I will think of this no more. Miotoka turned her back on our people. The Great Spirit has taken her and her children in punishment. I cannot bear such a loss, and must not think of it. It is done."
"There is more bad news. White Eyes has died. He was in Fort Pitt to counsel with other chiefs, and left with the American army and crossed the river at Fort McIntosh. They say he died of the pox, but there are some who dispute that, and say he was murdered by a soldier. Many of our people have joined the Ohio tribes in favor of the British. Captain Pipe has taken his followers to the Indiana Territory, where he will follow the Shawnee, who will never support the Americans. Those of us here in the Moravian villages and Newcomer's Town will stand with the Americans, but the loss of our cousin White Eyes greatly diminishes our influence. George Morgan, the Indian agent, has requested 2 of my sons and White Eyes' son to meet with him at Fort Pitt, where he intends to talk to them about returning east, where they will be schooled in the manner of the whites. I believe that our people must embrace white ways, or we will no longer be a people. You must hope that the Americans defeat the British, or your sons will be lost."
"The Americans will win. They are close to winning as we speak. I have no fear. They will become an independent nation, and we must have a part of it, or we are lost."
Kilbuck spent the next year in mourning. He tried to see signs. He tried to agree with his son, and tried to find God. But he could not embrace Christianity.
"Why," he wondered, "why would the white man's God allow the whites to be killed in such great number? Why would so many white captives prefer the life of an Indian?"
He also knew that many of the Delaware and most of the Shawnee looked with scorn on those who followed the Moravians because they were certain the missionaries were spies for the Americans. It was a small number of Delaware who had converted to Christianity. Kilbuck had not, but his sons had. But he would not take up the hatchet against the Americans. He did not understand nor believe that the white man's God was preferable to his ancestral spirits. In the meantime, Pipe and his followers returned to Coshocton, now the principal Delaware village, not far from Newcomer's Town and the Moravian villages. Kilbuck knew there would be further conflict. Chapter 9. By 1780, the Americans were once again turning their attention to the rebellious tribes of the Ohio Valley. They would soon defeat the British and send their generals to subdue the Indians. Raids had continued with vengeance into the Kentucky land and all along the Ohio River. Hundreds of Indians and settlers had been killed, and the name of the great frontiersmen, Simon Kenton and Daniel Boone, put fear into those who encountered them. The Delaware remained a divided nation, and watched as the American Colonel Broadhead assembled an army to march deep into the Ohio country. One night, when the inhabitants of Newcomer's Town gathered for a harvest celebration, pleased that they would gather enough corn to last through the winter, Kilbuck rose and asked for silence. All turned their attention to the revered old chief as he spoke.
"Brothers, my winters have been many, but there are few ahead. The white, like seeds scattered in the wind, have multiplied. Our people have not,
and our ancestral lands are no longer occupied by those who revered the land and its inhabitants. Our people have been pushed toward the setting sun, without hope. The old Lenape nation has been divided into pieces that no longer fit together, brother against brother, and we cannot unite. Those who profess peace side with the Americans, yet some of our people refuse to accept their terms. And I, as former war chief of the Turtle Clan, father of Gelalemond, principal chief, grandfather of half-breeds, most dead by the hands of our own people, no longer have influence. Only sadness fills my heart. I cry at my losses, at our losses. I am saddened by the loss of my family. The Great Spirit no longer favors our cause. We are lost, I fear. I pray that my son will not lose sight of his people and will make decisions wisely. I have lived my life with no regrets. I have killed many and have no remorse. I failed to kill enough white men to stop their encroachment. They, too, took the lives of many warriors. I mourn the death of the great Shingas and White Eyes. I pray that Captain Pipe will live to see success as he joins with the Shawnee to continue the fight that we have turned away from. War is cruel and favors no one in its execution. The gods did not interfere, but the white god is strong, and his people are stronger than we are. There was silence among the gathered warriors. The women began their death chant, and soon their cries echoed across the valley. Several weeks later, with much dismay, Killbuck watched his son Gelalemond and three warriors leave for Fort Pitt to proclaim their loyalty to the Americans and seek supplies. During the absence of Gelalemond, Pipe called a council at the village of Coshocton, now considered the capital of the Delaware Nation. Killbuck and other warriors sat at the fire, and Killbuck prepared to defend his absent son if necessary. But the imposing Captain Pipe took control and pleaded with the remaining warriors to join the hostile tribes, the Shawnee and the Wyandots, in continuing the fight against the Americans. Pipe began the controversy. "We are deeply divided, brothers, and our nation is split. Today we saw the Shawnee party return with scalps and captives taken from their Kentucky raids. We heard their victorious cries as they rode through our village calling us squaws. You are wrong, brother. The Ohio tribes will unite and fight the Americans. It is the British who will help us. They do not want to lose the land. I know the Americans are not our friends, but I know that they will win, and we will have to live with them. Their numbers are too great." "You are wrong, brother. The Americans have put a spell on your son. You support him, your blood. The British have promised us a treaty if they win. We will keep the Ohio and Kentucky lands." "You cannot see the truth, Pipe. I hate all white men as do you, but you prefer to fight despite the odds against us. We cannot join the hostile tribes. It will be the death of our nation, which is already split." "I will join the hostile tribes, as will most of our warriors. You and your son have no power to stop us. It is done." "I beg you, brother, do not do this. Do not join the northern tribes. Wait until my son returns from Fort Pitt." Killbuck said, "Pipe, the British and French are our enemies. They have always been our enemies. The Americans will win this war. They are here. The British father is far away across the great water. The British have never learned to fight. But the Americans are wise in the ways of war. They have learned from us." Only a handful of warriors rejected the proposal and returned to Newcomerstown with Killbuck to await Gelalemond's return. Killbuck had watched in despair as he saw his son struggle with the war faction of the Delaware. Since the death of White Eyes, Gelalemond had managed to control those warriors who wanted war and hated the Americans. They watched as the Shawnee and others joined together in raiding the Kentucky settlements and others.
They heard the tales of the deaths of those who dared to take flatboats from Fort Pitt down the Ohio, seeking land for settlement. Kilbuck sent a faithful runner to intercept his son and the others on their return. The runner was to inform Gelelemon of the council's decision to join the war faction of the Ohio tribes. He would warn him not to go to Coshocton, where the hostile Delaware threatened his life, but instead to come to Newcomerstown. Kilbuck's family and the son of White Eyes settled in Newcomerstown to await Gelelemon's return. When the warriors arrived, Gelelemon sought out John Heckewelder, one of the Moravian missionaries, to write a letter to Colonel Broadhead, outlining the situation. The letter expressed the loyalty of Gelelemon and his family and a few others, and suggested that Broadhead lead an expedition against Coshocton in order to subdue the hostile Delawares and protect those who remained loyal. The division among the Delaware remained severe, while Kilbuck and his family remained in Newcomerstown, waiting for word from Broadhead. Chapter 10. By April, Broadhead had secured supplies and a group of volunteers from Fort Henry and the surrounding area. The local frontiersmen were known Indian haters, having seen raids take the lives of their families and neighbors in recent years. The army of 300 crossed the Ohio in the second week of April during tremendous rainstorms, causing much distress among the men. It was a week before the army met the missionary Heckewelder on the trail by the Tuscarora River. Broadhead wanted to know if any Christian Indians remained in Coshocton. The missionary assured him that the Christian Indians remained secure in Salem. That day, Gelelemon's runner arrived at Salem. "Brother, Broadhead is within a day of Coshocton and will destroy the village. We must stay here for safety." As Gelelemon prepared to return to Coshocton and the Moravian villages nearby, he was caught by a runner from Fort Pitt with a warning. The warriors, bent on following the hostile tribes, threatened to kill the Kilbuck family and White Eye's son. When Gelelemon returned to Newcomerstown, he wrote to Broadhead to lead the army against the hostiles. The missionary, John Heckewelder, wrote the letter, which was carried back to Fort Pitt by John Montour, a half-breed who supported the Americans. Heckewelder also suggested that Broadhead lead an expedition against Coshocton to quell the renegades. Soon Broadhead secured supplies, and a group of volunteers from the Fort Henry area, including some very prominent Indian haters. The army of 300 was led by Montour and several Delaware warriors who had remained at Fort Pitt. They crossed the Ohio and several days later met Heckewelder on the road. They wanted to know if any Christian Indians remained in Coshocton. The missionary said the Christians were safe in the Moravian villages. When Gelelemon heard the Americans were close, he summoned three followers and said, "Put on your war paint. We must show the Americans that we do not follow the hostiles. We will bring back their scalps." "It is good they come. Now I will seek to destroy those who threaten me and my family. Captain Pipe and his warriors have divided our nation, and no good will come of it. I will present Broadhead with a symbol of my loyalty so that we may be saved." Kilbuck stood at his son's side. "My son, do not be hasty. This will only divide our nation more. Do not seek revenge from our people. I beg you." "Father, I will do what I must. This is the only way our people can be saved." Kilbuck watched them ride out of the village. His heart beat rapidly in his chest with fear. Fear for his son and what might come. Captain Pipe and his followers were on their way to Detroit to confer with renegade Indians and French. Thus Coshocton was left without its principal warriors and had no scouts or expectation of Broadhead's closeness. It was late in April that the Americans came across three Indians, killed one, but two escaped in order to give the alarm to Coshocton. 40 additional warriors had just returned from raiding and crossed the river north of Coshocton in order to celebrate their victory and the scalps hanging from their belts. Their celebration included jugs of rum from the French, and soon most were totally consumed by drunkenness. Their cries echoed across the river. 2 days later, Kilbuck listened to the report of Broadhead's advance. The army had killed a scout from Coshocton, but two others managed to warn the village.
Gelaleman had returned with a bloody scalp that he threw at Broadhead's feet upon his return to Coshocton. "Now you have proof of our loyalty. Here is the scalp of one of the worst of the renegades. The others have sought safety with the French at Fort Detroit." A look of horror spread across Kilbuck's face as he watched his son throw the scalp. The village of Coshocton was soon completely destroyed, and the defending warriors killed by the vengeful militia. Broadhead ordered his troops to make ready to cross the river and go after the other Delaware warriors while they were in a drunken state, celebrating the bringing home of scalps and captives. The river was swollen from the rains, and the militia had had enough of the bad weather and the killing. And so the expedition lingered near the burned village, slaughtering the Indians' cattle and feasting on the beef, while Kilbuck and his family remained in Newcomer's Town. A day later, when the soldiers arrived, Gelaleman pleaded with Broadhead to take them to Fort Henry for protection. He feared retaliation upon those who maintained the peace. Broadhead agreed, and allowed a small group of mostly Christian Delawares to accompany him and his soldiers back to Fort Henry, where they would be protected. Kilbuck and his son, with the others, rode back with the soldiers. It was nearly dusk when Kilbuck and the few Delaware, along with the army with him, crossed the Ohio River at the ford below Wheeling and Fort Henry. The setting sun shone orange shadows on the faces of the men and the landscape. Trotting along the bank toward the fort, Kilbuck watched the soldiers and volunteers as some rode by, anxious to be relieved of their duties. He saw the looks of hate in the faces of the local militia, and knew they would kill him if they could. Suddenly, a soldier turned toward him, and for a second or two, Kilbuck saw the orange glow reflected on the man's face. The glow quickly turned to flames which engulfed the man's face until only a dark ember remained. Kilbuck closed his eyes and turned away. It was a sign, he knew, a bad sign. That man would die in flames. Turning to the soldier who rode next to him, Kilbuck said, "Who is that man? What is his name?" He pointed to the soldier who rode ahead of him now. "That's Colonel Crawford. He'll soon lead men of his own against your people." He laughed. "He is a great soldier." Kilbuck's face was a mask. "No, he will not return from that mission. He will die in flames." The soldier looked puzzled, but soon rode on ahead. When the group arrived at Fort Henry, Colonel Broadhead motioned to the Delaware warriors to come forward. He explained that they would spend the night in the confines of the fort. "It is for your safety, friends. You see the looks of our volunteers. They will harm you if they have a chance. I am sorry, but it is for your protection." Kilbuck had seen over 70 winters and knew he would see no more. His eyesight was poor, and he allowed his nephew to help him into the fort and the building designated as the jail. He had never been jailed in his life, and his stomach rebelled at the thought. But it was of necessity, he knew. He had seen through his blurry eyes the looks of hate among the soldiers he passed. They hated Indians, he knew, and some remembered his past deeds, deeds which haunted him, but still did not produce remorse. He felt the bond with the Great Spirit, and knew he did what was necessary at the time. He had no hate for those he had killed. His hate was reserved for the acts of taking the land that belonged to his people. He did what he had to survive. He thought of his daughter and grandchildren, dead at the hands of his people, the red men. His seed dispersed. He thought of Shingus and the others, now dead. He thought of Captain Pipe, who still lived and fought somewhere. For several hours, Kilbuck and his nephew and another warrior sat silently on stools in the wooden enclosure. Kilbuck's hands were on his knees and eyes closed when he heard a crack of the door. He did not turn, but waited silently while dread filled his body. He feared the worst, and felt the blow. That was all he felt as his world turned to blackness. Author's Notes. The story of Kilbuck is a complicated one, and much of his story remains unknown. There is no proof of his birth or death.
Much of what is known about his life comes from second-hand sources. The Journal of Moravian Missionary David Heckewelder is a first-hand source that clearly differentiates Kilbuck from his son Gelelemond, known as John Kilbuck Jr., and who is often confused in the records. Kilbuck Sr. was described by the Reverend Jones, who wanted to preach in the Indian villages in 1773, as a respectable gentleman. Kilbuck was a remarkable and intelligent man. He spoke several languages, according to several accounts, and was a fair man despite his taking of many lives. The reader should consider the position the Delaware were in during and after the French and Indian War. They were caught between two powerful white forces, first the French and the British, and then the British and the Americans. These forces eventually swallowed up the Ohio tribes despite their efforts. In addition, scalping was common practice by the British, and then the Americans. George Washington himself even took scalps to the Ohio tribes in trying to gain their allegiance to the Americans. Kilbuck, Shingas, and others did what they could to retain their ancestral lands and culture, but despite their efforts, failed. In addition, the treaties with the British, then the Americans, were never fulfilled despite the efforts of Kilbuck and Shingas, then Pontiac, and finally the great Shawnee Tecumseh during and after the French and Indian War. There is no doubt they were swallowed up by the white, powerful forces that eventually conquered them. Kilbuck's death is described in Alan Eckert's That Dark and Bloody River. Eckert's sources are the Draper Papers, held by the Wisconsin Historical Society, and not examined by this author, but accepted. His son, Gelelemond, died in 1811, as established by the records. The two men are often confused in various accounts, but a journal entry by Heckewelder clearly establishes that the father and son were both alive during the 1770s. The story of Kilbuck's two daughters and their marriages to John Brake and John Schoolcraft are not proven, but it is known that Schoolcraft's wife and six of their children were killed in an Indian raid in 1779. The raiding party were most likely Shawnee, who were very active in Virginia at that time. The story persists that Schoolcraft's wife was Minioka, daughter of the war chief Kilbuck. The story of a sister marrying Brake is not so prevalent. After Kilbuck's death in 1781, Colonel David Williamson took an army into Ohio, where he brutally murdered the Moravian Indians, who he enticed into a building and locked up. There are stories of some soldiers who refused to comply, and no list exists of those who committed the murders. The act infuriated the Ohio Indians as well as the Delaware, who had gone against the Moravians. They united in anger and waited for revenge. Shortly after the massacre, Colonel William Crawford led an army of Americans into Ohio to subdue the hostiles once and for all. Indian spies watched the army cross the Ohio and begin their march into the Ohio country. In the meantime, hundreds of Indians from many tribes had assembled and waited for their opportunity. Captain Pipe, the Delaware, was among those who waited along with Simon Girty. The army was caught in an ambush. Many fled back to the Ohio, and Crawford and others were captured and killed. Crawford's death, burned at the stake after agonizing hours being tortured, is a story in itself. It is said that Crawford pleaded with Girty to kill him, but Girty would not put him out of his misery, because he feared for his own life. Battles continued over the next few decades until General Anthony Wayne defeated the Indians in 1794. Ohio soon became a state, and the Indians gave up the southern half of the state, which exploded in white settlement. The Christian Delaware had moved with the Moravians to Canada, and others to Indiana. In 1813, Tecumseh orchestrated the last stand by the Indians of the Ohio Valley at the Battle of the Thames in Canada. The British refused promised aid, and the Indians were defeated with Tecumseh's death. The last of the Indians left Ohio in 1832 when they were marched to a reservation. Kilbuck's grandson, Charles Henry Kilbuck, wrote a remarkable history of his people, and there are many who claim descent from this remarkable man. This has been The Quest, A Warrior's Tale, written by Bonnie S. Johnston, narrated by William Dupuy. Copyright 2015 by Bonnie S. Johnston. Production copyright 2015 by Bonnie S. Johnston.